And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week on the show, we're going to talk about the Golden Globes. You may have seen them. You may not have seen them. You may have heard that opinions differed about the fate of Ricky Gervais, just like last year, but perhaps...
Wait, did he not live?
Did they?
Exactly.
Did the opinions really differ?
A little bit, maybe. So we'll get to that. We're also going to talk a little bit about criticism and Twitter and long versus short form writing, and we'll get into that a little bit later. And as always, we will end by talking about our favorite thing, what is making us happy this week. Now, you may notice, once again, as last week, I'm slightly froggy. I apologize in advance. But before we get underway, let's introduce everybody who is not speaking with a frog in their throat. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
Well, I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a Reddit. The movies editor at NPR.org.
We're early out of the gate with the cats of slow clap this week. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Glenn, would you like to give me a little The Quick Brown Fox Jumped Over the Lazy Dog in your own voice? I know you're having an issue with people telling the difference between you and Trey.
Yes. This is Glenn. Trey, you want to jump in there?
This is Trey.
See?
Oh, they're worlds apart.
Yeah, see, I don't hear
we
it.
We can't help it. We grew up this way.
I don't hear the similarity, but, you know, some
just,
do.
Just, if you can't tell Trey Graham and Glenn Weldon apart, just think Trey, opera, nephews. Glenn, comic books, misanthropy.
There you go.
There you go.
That?
Yep.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. So how many people here watched the Golden Globes?
I believe all of us watched the Golden Globes.
I think all of us,
You guys all watched them together, and I was still in mourning.
Yeah, you were.
That's true.
If you did not catch this, I won't make Stephen explain it, but Stephen's football team will not be winning the Super Bowl this year, and that's all that we're going to say about that. He had a difficult day on Sunday.
It was an egg-laying of epic proportions.
He had a difficult day on Sunday. All right, so since I already know a little bit about how Trey and Glenn responded to the Golden Globes in the moment.
From the things they threw at the screen.
Exactly. As far as the show itself, in terms of the presentation, what did you think?
Well, I mean, I think the elephant in the room of the Golden Globes is, like last year, the hosting of Ricky Gervais.
He doesn't care who he...
he doesn't care whose toes he steps on. who, I think, sort of proved definitively something that I've been saying for a while, which is that the very notion of subversion is dead.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's one thing if you're the elephant in the room, and it's another thing a year later when you are the paid, trained elephant in the room.
Well, he was the paid, trained elephant last year, too. It was just as inauthentic to have him come in and like, whoa, he's just going to rip a strip out of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. You know, again, he doesn't care whose toes
he's making
on.
Jokes about Kim Kardashian.
Oh, my God, Mel Gibson.
Yeah. What will be next?
You know, Tom Cruise. So bringing him back was sort of the ultimate death knell of the notion that he's going to like really come in there and bite the hand that feeds him because the hand fed him and then is feeding him again.
Right. Yeah.
And so having him step out and do sort of a 6-minute monologue when he actually did like, here's a list of things that they said I couldn't say.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, wow.
Now, the Hollywood Foreign Press have warned me that if I insult any of you or any of them, or offend any viewers, or cause any controversy whatsoever, they'll definitely invite me back next year as well. They actually gave me a list of rules. I'm going to ignore them, but I thought it'd be good to read them out, okay? This is real, okay? No profanity, that's fine. I've got a huge vocabulary. No nudity. See, that's a shame, because I've got a huge vocabulary. But a tiny penis. No, it's true. Doesn't matter. I don't care. It works. Don't worry about it. It's fine. It's fine. I don't. And I mustn't mention Mel Gibson this year. Not his private life, his politics, his recent films, and especially not Jodie Foster's Beaver. I haven't seen it myself. I've spoken to a lot of guys here. They haven't seen it either. But that doesn't mean it's not any good.
And then it turned out to be like Justin Bieber jokes and jokes about
right.
Madonna.
Mel Gibson.
Oh, the joke about Madonna, where he mentions she's coming out and does a Like a Virgin joke and then rolls his eyes. Mm-hmm. Come on.
That's only about four decades old.
Exactly. That joke could have been done 30 years ago and it would have been hacked.
Dave Itzkoff had a great piece in the New York Times Magazine over the weekend. It was about the fact that Ricky Gervais has spent sort of his whole career, but especially the last year, really pushing hard this idea of like, I'm so dangerous, I'm so crazy. And the way that Dave put it that I thought was so smart, he's either sort of titillating people with being offensive or titillating people, more accurately, with the idea that someone else somewhere is offended.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's so true.
And it's like, you're not really necessarily offending anyone. It's just that everyone is enjoying that feeling of like, this is so out there. Like, this is so edgy.
Naughty.
And he's selling it on the idea that I'm going to offend a bunch of people who aren't you, and you'll get to sit there and be like, ooh, he really
zinged them.
Yeah.
It's kind of a shame to me, because not a year and a half or 2 years ago, we were all giggling at that delightful outtake from Sesame Street where he and Elmo get the giggles together.
Yes.
And I like that Ricky Gervais. I don't like this new Ricky Gervais.
I still don't hate Ricky Gervais.
But I
think that what really doesn't work for him as a host is he honestly courts no goodwill at all. Mm-hmm. Often the host of these things, it's such an incredibly inherently awkward endeavor hosting an awards show, because everybody's sort of judging your every word. There's this nervousness in the room. It's just kind of an awkward thing. Presiding over a bunch of actors being validated is a very awkward endeavor. The tightrope of watching a comedian try to hold the attention of the room and hold the attention of the billion people, not that a billion people watch the Golden Globes, but 17 million people at home. For me, there's a certain amount of like, come on, you can do it, that I feel when I'm watching a host. And so much of it is persona. I mean, he's David Brent.
Exactly.
I don't have that sense of rooting for him.
I was talking to a British colleague of mine, and her phrase for it was something I'd never heard people say, but it's exactly right. She says he over-eggs the pudding.
Yes, indeed.
It means exaggerating. And she was talking specifically about his London boy character, his, what we call in America, his just plain guyness, or what was in full display that night was, I calls him as I sees him. But it's exaggerated. He puts too many eggs in the pudding. I thought that was brilliant.
I think one problem they definitely had this year that's a greater problem than they had last year, they spent the last year telling this narrative of like, last year it was so daring, it was so out there, like the whole thing of like, wow, he made a joke about Robert Downey Jr. being in rehab, wow, he made a joke about Hugh Hefner being really old,
wow, and he made a joke about Scientology,
which I felt was a great exaggeration from the get-go. And then they spent the last year playing up that narrative and being like, will he be so dangerous again? So I think by the time they got to this show, they were partly dealing with a situation where people remembered his performance last year being far more edgy and interesting than it
actually
was.
He would have had
to
remove clothing to, you know, to get anybody's attention.
So when you get out there and he starts telling jokes about Justin Bieber impregnating somebody with a turkey baster, it's lame, but it's especially lame if you've sort of trained your brain to think that last year he was really dangerous and edgy, much more.
Well, the fact
than
that
I
he hasn't gone on a publicity tour following the Golden Globes like he did last year to kind of say, "Hey, I didn't offend anyone, and if I did, screw them," I think proves that he knows he didn't offend anyone this year.
I'm sorry. When George Clooney gets a bigger laugh with an entrance and a prop than you get all night long,
It's true.
Ultimately, beyond the first 6 minutes of the telecast, Ricky Gervais did not have a strong presence at these awards. And I think, in a sense, we're probably devoting more time to talking about him than he had on stage.
Right.
How did you guys feel about the actual awards themselves?
Well, I think the strongest presence of the evening clearly was Angelina Jolie's dress.
I thought it was clearly Angelina Jolie's freakish arms, which appear to be made of very small twigs.
Yeah. Trey and I had a little bit of a difference of opinion about this dress. I did not care that much for that dress.
We had a fierce debate about whether Angelina Jolie's dress was the most glamorous thing in the history of glamour, which was my position, or whether it made her look like a starving vampire, which was pretty much Linda's position.
Without getting too Joan Rivers, I felt like the the bodice was a little too hard looking. Like, I thought it was a little bit cone bra looking. I didn't, and in that sense, I didn't think it was terribly flattering. But you know, I seem to be in the great minority about that. So
That scarlet slash across the bodice.
And I would certainly defer.
And then the scarlet lipstick, and then the scarlet, clutch that brought it all together.
I'll tell you exactly what's happening right now. Glenn is sitting here right now saying, "Linda, please say yes, Trey."
Yes, Trey.
I was just thinking the same thing. Like, people can honestly not tell Trey Graham and Glenn Welch apart. Glenn is the one who is sighing right now.
Yeah, well.
Yes.
I also want to give a shout out to Emma Stone's dress. She wore a thing that looked like the Black Swan had mated with Aquaman's pants. It was sort of dark green and scaly and sequiny and feathery all at once, and it was stunning.
So Trey's into the dress.
Yeah, there was no like Pia Zadora, like why did this person win moment. I mean, Matt LeBlanc came close.
Kelsey Grammer.
You know what?
He got really good reviews for that show.
You know what? When Matt LeBlanc walked on stage, I was not overwhelmed, but I felt a breeze of, I like that guy.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, sure.
Oh, and he was like, very likable on that show.
We should remind people what this show is. This is a thing called Episodes that hasn't been on for about a year, right?
But
it's a Showtime scripted drama comedy.
Played himself, much as Neil Patrick Harris has played himself and James Vanderbeek is about to play himself.
Right.
This was Matt LeBlanc as a fictionalized, much doofier version of Matt LeBlanc.
Like I said, I just felt this, like, not a tidal wave of goodwill, but a breeze of goodwill, where I realized, like, you know what, I kind of missed that guy, and I was happy to see him succeed.
And that's a very Golden Globes-y thing. They love to sort of go back to people that they've loved in the past. You know, we mentioned Kelsey Grammer winning for his Starz show, Boss, which is a big drama, but they loved him on Frasier, so it's like, oh, we love that guy, and there is some of that.
Well, they clearly like Matt LeBlanc, given that he had been previously nominated, not just for Friends, but for Joey.
Yeah, and it's true.
Oh, the Golden Globes.
Favorite part of the evening, I guess. I mean, Dinklage is always, he's just a class act.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Peter Dinklage won for
Peter Dinklage,
Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
My favorite part of the evening was the titles of the foreign film nominees. Because if you were making a parody of names of foreign films,
Rochelle.
The Flowers of War. Uh-huh. The Kid with a Bike.
Right?
And the Land of Sand and Blood and Despondency, or whatever it is. I don't know. It was a lot of fun.
I think, you know, the Golden Globes do still have that reputation for being a little bit goofy. And I think that, you know, as I said about Gervais, one of the problems is they have a little bit of a tendency to overpromise because they have something of a history of recognizing people who don't get recognized at the Oscars. There was actually a piece that was written somewhere this year in the lead up saying essentially they're better awards than the Oscars.
Yeah,
they do a better job of recognizing. And there's some of that, but
you can cut those
in both ways. The Globes are one of those events where people are in the mood to start getting excited about this kind of stuff.
Right.
So they tend to be overexcited about the Golden Globes, which are, after all, you know, handed out by a relatively small group of people whose credentials are not necessarily the most distinguished members of the foreign press.
It doesn't even mean that they cover movies or entertainment all full time.
And I don't mean that. They're not good, but you don't have to be like an incredible superstar journalist.
One of the main differences between the two telecasts is that Morgan Freeman bit aside, there's less sort of self-importance.
Well, they're trying to get through a lot of awards because they have movies and TV, so there's a little bit less of the sort of, and now a segment
about... A salute
about,
to the movies!
That's right. Yeah.
You know, the other thing, of course, is that the Golden Globes also kind of bring back TV to getting awards, and some of the things that are up for awards at the Golden Globes haven't been up for Emmys yet, so this is just sort of your first opportunity to recognize Homeland and things like that in a big awards ceremony. So it mixes up TV and movies. It brings those things together, which you often don't see. And that does mean that some categories get smushed together a little bit, like
in
all
very
of the
silly
TV
ways.
Supporting actresses, for example, are mushed together, which as several people giggled about. You get your Maggie Smith versus Sofia Vergara showdown, which is sort of like, wow, that's two completely different kinds of just fine with me.
I will say that I saw a few more moments of kind of spontaneity and charm than you get from your average Oscars telecast, for sure. How often do you get something quite as delightful as Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy walking out and doing their little duet?
These actresses did stunning work, heartbreaking, true and bold. The four will go home empty-handed, one will take home gold. Don't be humiliated, 'cause you all did a terrific job. It's an honor to be nominated. Blah, 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 blah.
That was really
that was cute.
Which had no right to work. I mean, it was a prepared little bit, and usually that's death, but they were great.
Yeah, they were.
So here's another question. Does Kate Winslet ever not win anything anymore?
And, she's hard to beat.
And why then does she still look so surprised?
Well, it's the Taylor
you
Swift
mean the
problem.
Way, which is, it's you also mean the way Meryl Streep looks surprised?
I was going to say, it is also the Meryl Streep problem, which is that Meryl Streep, who has won everything many times, still practically had to be carried to the stage.
Right.
She was so
shocked.
Overwhelmed by the shock and awe of winning for an award that everyone knew she was going to win.
But here's the thing, though. You can't be the person who, like, smiles knowingly, and, like, as I expected.
I can't expect it. I'm not saying that she should
you
walk up
just,
and
like,
be like...
You can't just, spread your hands wide open and be like... Well, yes. You can't, like, turn to your date and be seen mouthing, like, well, sure.
Duh.
I don't want to rag on poor Meryl Streep too much, but speaking of rags, what was she wearing?
Oh, for
a cowboy
God's
shirt.
Sake.
She's wearing a cowboy shirt with a skirt.
You know what? This is this is exactly the moment that I wish we had on this podcast. I was thinking about this watching the Golden Globes. I want Mike Katziff to have access to an orchestra. so that he can play me.
So he can play this segment off.
He can play me out of an anecdote.
All right. Before we go, they did give out a couple of big movie awards at the end, which either are or aren't an indication of what might happen at the Oscars. Any thoughts?
This, to me, made it abundantly clear that mark my words, that The Artist will clearly win Best Picture at the Oscars.
Because
it's about movies, and it's about movie making, and it's about nostalgia.
Hugo.
Yeah,
so
I was
going to
say,
so
I'm going to say Hugo's going to be tight in the running for that.
Clearly, the Descendants was kind of your big, like, end of telecast, like, everybody gets up, and the Descendants has won a lot of the big ones. I do think George Clooney will win Best Actor. I think The Artist will win for two reasons. One is, as you said, you can't go wrong sort of writing a love letter to the cinema. The other reason is... If you're going to bite the hand that feeds you and tear down a giant in the room, how about no jokes about Harvey Weinstein, who showed up in that telecast about 15 times. Yeah. Every single time was someone kissing his ass. The fact that Harvey Weinstein really seems to have figured out how the awards game works to the point where you've got to kind of spot whatever movie he's working an extra touchdown. Mm-hmm. And The Artist had that. The Meryl Streep movie had that. And there's another one.
The Marilyn Monroe. Williams Marilyn Monroe.
Right, which would lead me to believe that I think that will get nominated for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. There was so much sort of disproportionate Harvey Weinstein thanking that leads me to believe that you're going to see the Artist pick up a lot of steam.
It's a theory.
It's a theory, and it is a correct one.
I'm going to say that you're wrong about Clooney. I read an interesting proposition in the wake of the Golden Globes, which is that Clooney and Pitt are having so much fun in their bromance that Clooney, having won the Golden Globe, is going to be a buddy and campaign for Pitt.
Bah. I think George Clooney can and should win. I think that's a great performance.
Well, I'm glad that we all made it through the telecast. And, of course, you're all welcome, as always, to come find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or find us at the blog at MonkeyC and let us know what you thought of the Golden Globes, the Golden Globes winner, and the outstandingly dangerous Golden Globes jokes. Now, we have spent some time here, as you can tell, discussing the Golden Globes, critiquing the Golden Globes, as it were, despite the fact that many of us had a few things to say about the Golden Globes on Sunday night on Twitter. It's almost like Twitter didn't seem like it was necessarily a complete discussion.
Wait, what are you getting at? You seem to be getting at a theory.
What am I getting at? Recently, Spin Magazine explained that they were not eliminating reviews and not eliminating long reviews, but they were eliminating all of their capsule reviews of albums, and they were going to switch to a different system. Stephen, you have done some reading about this. Why don't you explain what they're doing?
So Spin Magazine, which it should be noted is going to 6 issues a year, which I do think does justify some of what they're doing, moving some more of their operations online, because it's very hard to do. You know, we're in a rapid response world, and having practically a quarterly magazine devoted to music is a difficult proposition.
So what are they doing?
So what they're doing is they are starting at Spin Reviews, and it's a project where they're planning to review something like 1,500 albums a year, entirely on Twitter, entirely in the form of tweets. This project is being headed up by a critic named Chris Weingarten, who tweets under the name thousand times yes, and who is known in the Twitterverse as a guy who on Twitter reviewed like 1,000 albums in 2009. Of course, it being Twitter, they tended to take on kind of a sarcastic, dismissive tone. And so now he is the reviews editor at Spin and taking the reviews to Twitter.
Well, now let's step back for one second.
Sure.
Because I personally think that what set off the controversy here was not necessarily what they were actually doing.
Right.
Because they're not getting rid of all their long-form criticism. They're getting rid of capsule reviews, which I think a lot of people feel are not all that valuable anyway, and which often don't necessarily receive the same loving attention as longer-form writing anyway.
Right.
So I'm not sure, and as you said, with them going down to six a year, I'm not sure it's the Twitter thing itself that caused the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem was in the way that they wrote about it.
Yeah, when they how they framed this announcement and the reasons they gave.
Because the framing, I think, was the bigger issue.
The framing was catastrophic in its misguidedness.
Yeah.
If I may read from their statement.
Right.
The Standard Music Review, once presented as an imperious edict, has increasingly frayed into a
I'm sorry, you've lost me already.
Seriously. Has increasingly frayed into a redundant, gratuitous novelty in an era of fewer and fewer actual music consumers. Pucky.
it's both redundant and gratuitous.
Well, and what he goes on to say, if I can,
there's a whole bunch more, but I could not let fewer and fewer actual music consumers pass.
My issue with what he goes on to do is he goes on to basically say criticism is no longer very important because everybody has the ability to download everything for free the minute that it's available to anyone, and a lot of stuff is leaked anyway. So you probably have the same ability to listen to it to yourself and decide whether you think it's good, and the critic doesn't have the advantage over you in terms of getting free CDs, basically.
Right.
So therefore, criticism is no longer really very important.
Which is an astonishing...
That's where I
which
got
is just
wrong.
An astonishingly reductive idea about the nature and value of criticism.
And self-defeating.
Yeah, can we take the temperature of the room? Many critics, it seems to me, have a very complicated relationship with the notion that the critical essay they're writing, which puts whatever they're writing about in a cultural context and tries to say this band or this artist is doing something that this other artist attempts to do and here's how successful it is. A lot of critics, I think, have a very complicated relationship with the notion that that thing that they've written is going to be read by most of the people who read it as a consumer guide. Should I buy it or should I not?
Right.
So what do we feel in this room? Do we accept that?
I think that anything that you write like that, you should accept that a certain number of people do use information from critics as ways of deciding what movies to go to or what books to read or what albums to listen to.
Right.
At the same time, that doesn't mean that that's the sole usefulness of criticism.
No,
and it doesn't even necessarily mean that it is the most important use of criticism. Because, you know, not just music criticism, but criticism in general, like you said, exists to put things in a kind of cultural context and also to, you know, sometimes to challenge underlying assumptions. I don't know if this is as true in music, but certainly in books and in film. And you perhaps want to talk about whether those assumptions are troubling or whatever. There are a million reasons why you write about culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absolutely true that there are a certain number of people who really would rather that you just gave a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
Right.
But that's not everybody.
But no, I mean, there must be a fairly large population of people, even still, for whom reading good criticism is a pleasurable experience, right? It's the beginning of an argument, the beginning of a conversation.
Well, the whole notion that people aren't interested in reading anymore is just ridiculous.
All right. I'm going to end up saying I think he's got a point about one specific aspect of his argument. But let me start by saying I'm going to pay Stephen Thompson a rare compliment because I'm going to say that writing about music is inherently more difficult to do effectively and meaningfully than writing about books, television, comics, movies, etc. Because the emotional component of those media doesn't hit you right away. It kind of accrues to it as you experience the thing. So while you're waiting for the emotional, ineffable blues,
there's a little bit more of a conscious filter, I think.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. While you're waiting for the emotional thing to hit you or not hit you, while your heart is deciding how it feels, you're getting all this intellectual stuff that you can sort of get your mind around and discuss and write about, like plot, character, dialogue.
Yeah.
Synopsis.
Yeah, exactly. Structure. Now, in music, you can do that to some extent. You can certainly talk about the lyrical content, and you can talk...
Instrumentation and things like that.
And the history, contextualizing the history of the artist.
And you can talk about the actual composition, how the notes fit together. But music is pre-verbal. It is primal.
Yes. Yes.
Uh-huh. It hits you immediately, and it has a potency that I think language has a tough time addressing.
I agree. I have the same reaction that really good evocative music writing is to me in some ways more impressive than almost any other kind of cultural writing for exactly that reason. Although I will say I am the same way about really good criticism of dance for the same
reason. No, that makes sense.
Right. For the same reason.
That makes sense. You know, I grew up on Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone developed a jargon of things like laying down blistering licks and massive hooks. And I'll be honest, I have no idea what any of that means. Right. I still don't. It is a jargon in that it is exclusive. It keeps people out. So having the ability to listen to something yourself while that review is alongside it is, I think, a very positive development.
Right.
Yes. I, for example, skim music criticism. Then what I'm looking to you to tell me is, who is this artist band like? Do I like them? And then I will listen to it and I will make a decision. And then what I will do is go back to, after I've kind of interpolated the music, after I've kind of, you know, made it a part of my soul, I will go back to the review to help me articulate why I feel, to myself, why I feel about
I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a perfectly valid use of music criticism.
And then it's an intellectual conversation in a way. It's a conversation in your head between you and the critic where you're both equally informed because you both heard it.
Exactly. It's happening after the fact.
And the last thing the availability of the music does is make that less valuable.
Right. I agree.
Well, absolutely. And you know, you hit on a point, Glenn, that is part of my process is I'll listen to an album, write up a piece about it, and then I like to listen to the album again while reading the piece and see if I'm sort of capturing the essence of the album. I mean, one trick for you aspiring music writers, God, why would you want to, given that clearly Spin is flushing the last remaining jobs on the toilet. But I try to write about feeling, not my feelings. Mm-hmm. I almost never write about music in the first person.
Right.
But what does it feel like? What does this band represent in terms of mood? I just wrote about, you know, a record I talked about here last week, the Not a Surf record, The Stars Are Indifferent to Astronomy. And I had I sort of closed with, you know, it's formulaic in the same way that springtime is formulaic. Uh-huh. I wanted that to sort of evoke listening to this record has that like opening of your nasal passages, you know, that kind of you can breathe in deeper. You try to sort of artfully convey, sort of put the words in order in such a way that you're sort of doing this piece of music that you like justice. Now, I am in the enviable position of writing almost entirely recommendation-based reviews because of the nature of the way that NPR presents its first listens and its Song of the Day, and those are, you know, and the Tiny Desk concerts, and those are sort of the three features that I write for most often. And so much of my writing is recommendation-based, and so a lot of the jobs that a critic has nowadays or a reviewer has nowadays has been done behind the scenes that you can't see it. The job of a critic, I wrote down five words that happen to start with the letter C: curate, consume, cull, contextualize, and care.
Sure. I think that's a great list.
Yep.
Most of that is being done before you're sitting down to write. So you're listening to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of records in the hopes of finding stuff that you care about enough to write about it and that you can even fashion a strong enough opinion to bother crafting a thoughtful review.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. None of this is to take away from the fact that Twitter has become a really cool place to talk about a lot of different things. And
absolutely,
if you're really, really good at it, there you can definitely find great criticism in the form of Twitter. And as it happens, for those of you who are going to be at South by Southwest in March, I'm going to actually be on a panel talking about this very thing.
Nice.
So the interactive part. Yeah, exactly. I do believe in this, but I mean, I think of that as a complement to what you do in terms of longer writing. I don't think it's a replacement for it, and I don't think the reason why Twitter is valuable is that people don't care about criticism anymore, so therefore put it in the form of tweets because nobody cares that much.
Well, and here's another problem with Twitter, and I love me Twitter. I spend, you know, as much time reading Twitter as I spend reading a lot of things. My concern about Spin doing it is that a lot of times Twitter imposes a forced dismissiveness.
Right.
The kind of music writing I respond to the least is this: what does it say about me?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if the uncool people like this, right. and I like this, right. then I'm going to need to explain why.
Right.
If you boil that down to 140 characters, you are imposing a thoughtless,
right.
just brushing off of something that, right. that you know could stand to have more said about it. Which is to say nothing of the fact that they're not doing this in 140 characters. They're doing it in like 90 characters because you've got to include the band, the album, the byline, a score.
Yeah.
That leaves very little opportunity.
Right. They have a 10-point scale, so every review is being given a score between 1 and 10. Here, I just want to rattle off some of the scores of the last ones, all the ones I could find
on
this Twitter feed. 6, 8, 6, 7, 8, 7, 5, 7, 7, 5, 7, 7, 7, 5, 7, 6, 7, 5, 6, 6. So basically they're grading on a scale of 5 to 8.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
which
and I used to say that about...
all the not very informative things that you can say in 140 characters, they're cramming in a very limited... I mean, I know you've talked before about everything is a B+.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. I used to say about Rolling Stone all the time that they review albums on a 3 to 3.5 star scale.
Exactly.
And if you look...
Exactly.
I mean, the AV Club does letter grades, and if you a lot of times you'll see a sea of right. reviews on the right rail, and it's B+ or B, and it's like everything is B+ or
B. And they
B.
have not cracked that, and I think especially...
That's a hard nut to crack.
And here's the thing. Especially when you recognize that they are so clustered in terms of how recommendable they are,
right.
then it's even more important to provide context and talk about what you're actually saying. Now, my response to the thing that you were talking about with forced dismissiveness is that I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out why there are people whose writing I really like when they're writing full form, who on Twitter I tend to find kind of irritating. And one of the things I realized is that it rewards contrarianism to a great degree, because if you're trying to get attention in 140 characters, if you say, like, you know this show that a bunch of people think is good? I also think that show is good. Nobody's going to pay any attention to you in 440 characters. That may be all you have time to say.
Yep.
On the other hand, if you say, you know what? Justified sucks.
Yeah. Right.
Then all of a sudden people are like, what? And they're paying attention to what you're saying. So to me, not only is it a forced dismissiveness, but Twitter has a tendency to over-reward contrarianism because you have such limited space to make an impact and get people's attention.
And that tends to lead to a kind of music writing that I hate more than all other kinds of music writing, which is, here's the sort of person who's going to like this.
Exactly.
For people who blah, blah, blah.
For
there are already
blah, blah,
a couple
blah.
Like that on their feed when I looked at this interviews feed.
I find that actively loathsome. The tyranny of the wrong people like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me just say, coming at this from the outside, because I don't read a lot of music blogs besides NPR's.
of course.
I was surprised. Y'all are some judgy-ass nerds. You really are. Two sentences into any discussion, specifically about this whole Twitter spin thing, but what I would read blogs and the comments section, and two sentences in, I would hear in my voice Jack Black's voice from High Fidelity. Everybody sounds like that sneering record store clerk when they're talking to each other.
Well,
everyone's hyper-articulate, full of contempt, trying to one-up each other.
And even more so when you are trying to get attention and make an impact in a really short short space.
Yeah.
Also, everybody thinks it's incredibly novel to hate Coldplay.
Right. right. But this is, you know, I recognize this. This is what happens when nerdery curdles into disdain.
Superciliousness.
Disdain for those who like the thing you like, but for the wrong reasons.
Right. The takeaway for me is I like Twitter. I like criticism on Twitter. But I don't think that the growth of that has or should have anything to do with disdain for traditional criticism. And frankly, you know, I think part of what they're struggling with is, like, we don't feel like these are making an impact anymore. And maybe it's a mean thing to say, but you can't announce that the conversation is no longer important just because you don't feel like anybody's listening to you.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I feel like part of what they're saying is, like, we don't feel like anybody cares about Capsule reviews. And it's like, well, then maybe you need to find a way to enter that conversation differently instead of saying, it appears this conversation doesn't matter anymore.
And you know what? Lots and lots and lots of people are interested in reading music writing. And the other thing is that, you know what? Somebody should be paying writers to write about music.
Yeah. That's a great point. I can't imagine that tweeting is paying a fortune. The final segment of our show this week, as always, is what is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, why don't we start with you? What's making you happy this week?
I am going to make an attempt at sincerity. I will probably regret it.
People are going to think you're
trash.
That's right. Cover me. I'm going in. Monday's episode of the Mark Maron WTF podcast featured an interview with Todd Glass.
I keep hearing about this.
Mm-hmm. He is a very funny comedian who's been around forever. He's got a good, very loosely formatted podcast called The Todd Glass Show. This is a 47-year-old guy, born and bred in Paoli, Pennsylvania.
Nice.
What, 10 minutes away from where
nice.
I grew up.
Like,
okay, so the interview begins, and he comes out as a gay dude.
There you go. Hmm.
Over the next hour, the conversation that happens is by turns funny and sincere and poignant and thoughtful. He's getting a lot of love for coming out because of, you know, being brave, and he should. I totally support that. But speaking as somebody who went through a process, which from this interview sounds an awful lot like my process, mm-hmm. I can say that he's brave twice because he's coming out in a very public way, mm-hmm. not with a press release, not with a statement that's been kind of vetted by people, but by an hour-long conversation with a friend to whom he has been lying for his entire life.
Mm. Wow.
And, you know, they're not close friends, but this is a very confusing emotional time for anybody to do anything. It's just such a great interview. You hear in this interview a man beginning a very long process, mm-hmm. Beginning to understand that being honest with yourself and those around you doesn't change who you are. And you can tell from this interview, he doesn't quite believe that yet. But it doesn't mm-hmm. change who you are. It changes how you are, how you see the world, whether or not you find it a place that is threatening to where you need to kind of build a shell of lies just to kind of get through the day, mm-hmm. or if it's a place where you can actually breathe. Mm-hmm. He makes some really interesting points about the comedy culture, of course,
sure.
which is not a... There's no institutional homophobia in that culture. It's a relatively progressive culture.
Yeah.
But even the best comedians have those jokes that's like, mm-hmm. I'm going to say this horrible thing, because it's me saying it, and you know I don't really feel this way.
Uh-huh.
So how he negotiated that
over
the course of his life. So check this out. It is an amazing hour. I've never heard anything like this, and I don't know if I ever will again. Todd Glass's episode of WTF.
Does Mark Maron know it's coming?
Yes.
Okay.
It, just the whole buildup of how he finally decided to do it and why he decided to do it. It's just great. It's very intelligent, but check it out.
Awesome. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Sort of along those lines, we were talking earlier today, you and I, about a thing that's being passed around the Twitter, and that is the Michelle Williams interview, the cover story in the new GQ.
Yeah.
Which I still have a little bit of conflicted feeling mm-hmm. about, because I can't quite decide whether it's truly, truly heartbreaking or a little intrusive and exploitative. But to be fair, the writer sort of comes out and says that. His whole thesis is
he had a very wrenching experience spending time with her.
Just a stressful interview?
It was a series of interviews over several weeks.
They got together three times.
Yeah. You know, he asked some difficult questions of a person he doesn't really know.
Sure.
And her reactions were both honest and naked and vulnerable and pained.
In this last session, he speaks to her about Heath Ledger, who is the father of her daughter. They weren't together at the time that he died. Right. So clearly there had already been some fracturing in that relationship, but she also still clearly really loved him. And the writer doesn't really know exactly how much it's okay to ask about that. He knows people want to know about it. It's a profile that simultaneously really makes you think, like, this is why people love great profiles. It's really fascinating. It really gives you tremendous insight into her, how she talks, how she moves, how she walks, what she's like, what it's like to be around her. And it is fascinating. At the same time, it's a profile that makes you think, wow, especially for a person who has things about which she's delicate mm-hmm. and easily upset, it can really extract a cost for the person to sit for this kind of interview. So I share your conflicted feelings.
It was, if nothing else, despite the questions it raises about appropriate boundaries for an entertainment journalist, you know, how do you delicately ask painful questions, it is a fine piece of writing.
I think it's a fine piece of writing, and I think it's very honest. I think he tries very hard to be really fair mm-hmm. about, this is what I was doing, I felt guilty. And it's easy for those things to become, why are you talking about yourself?
Yeah.
Like, why are you talking about your experience of the interview?
Sure.
But in this
piece
one,
walks that line very nicely.
Yeah, I agree. In this one, a
couple of short little things.
Sure.
Cougartown is coming back.
Yes.
Yay.
February 14th, yeah.
Sherlock is coming back, not just, again, for a second season, but for a third season. It has been announced. The
wonderful.
News has been broken.
Wonderful, wonderful. Benedict Cumberbatch.
The people who have approached me on Twitter wanting to know if I write for that show, because there is a Stephen Thompson who does.
It's not you.
Nor am I the albino model.
And if I can swerve from Cougartown to highbrow, fancy pants, good fun, this week brings us the Criterion Collection's Blu-ray release of the 1967 film Belle de Jour.
Yes, it sure does.
You may have heard me waxing rhapsodic the other week about Catherine Deneuve in The Umbrellas of Schoenberg.
Uh-huh.
This is Catherine Deneuve as a bored housewife with some sexual fantasies.
Nice.
It was considered wildly transgressive in its day, and it absolutely made her an international superstar. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen, the Criterion Collection's Blu-ray version of Belle de Jour. You know, as always with things from Criterion, lots of lovely extras and a beautiful, beautiful print.
Nice. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, it's something that has actually made you happy before on this show, Linda. You have spoken of your love of the movie The Princess Bride.
Oh, I have.
Now, I also love the movie The Princess Bride, but I had the opportunity as part of Thompson Family Movie Night to make my kids watch it.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, most of you have seen The Princess Bride, its structure is such that it is a bedtime story being read to a very wee Fred Savage,
mm-hmm.
who was played by my daughter in my household. She did not want to see the Princess Bride, made a gigantic fuss about seeing The Princess Bride, insisted that it was clearly going to be about princesses or brides.
Yeah, she's swung around now. She's anti-princess. She's made
fiercely,
the full 180.
Fiercely anti-princess. We basically had a family fight to like make the kid, I mean, my son was willing to watch it,
right.
but she was not. By the time we got to the fire swamp,
sure.
She was literally on the edge of her seat, bouncing up and down. At times we almost had to rewind because the part with the old crone is like, boo, boo, you know, oh my God. So anyway, if you have children at home and they have not seen The Princess Bride, it was just an absolutely jaw-droppingly wonderful football-negating joy over this past weekend.
Wonderful. I'm so glad to hear it. Princess Bride, excellent recommendation. I have no particularly big one thing making me happy this week. Like Trey, I'm going to rattle off a couple of little things. One was, we talked about the Golden Globes. We did not talk about my absolute favorite thing about the Golden Globes, which was the table that Amy Poehler and Tina Fey were sitting at.
Yes.
Which
yes.
provided much of my best entertainment, both when Tina Fey essentially
photobombed yes.
the shot of Amy Poehler having her name read during the nominations for her category, and also the moment when Ricky Gervais made some stupid joke and there was a cut to Amy Poehler
lame.
That was just devastating. I mean, normally people affect these sort of polite faces. They cut to her a little too soon and she did not have her polite face on, and she was making this face like, that is the stupidest joke.
It was
devastating.
Fairly sure that I heard the sound of her eyes rolling in her head from across the continent.
It was devastating. She was wonderful. So that's A. Two is that ABC canceled Work It, which made it two episodes. As somebody pointed out on Twitter the other day, it lasted one day less than Press Tour from premiere to cancellation. So the critics sort of had their victory there. They
Who says criticism isn't valid?
Exactly. Press Tour outlasted Work It. Finally, I'm going to say Project Runway All-Stars, which if you're not watching Project really? Runway All-Stars, it is surprisingly compelling, very much like the recent Top Chef All-Stars season was excellent. Well done, Lifetime. This may be the best season since they moved it to Lifetime. I think it probably is, actually.
Wow.
So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show, which we hope will make you happy this week, just as it always makes us happy this week. Whether you are or aren't happy, you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E and Graham, just exactly like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. The music that you are hearing right now is Mike's band, Hello, Come In. They provide that in and out music that we love so much. So thanks to all of you guys for being here as always.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.